are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 6, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Michael Cohen returns to Congress. And so much for that. North Korea rebuilding missile test sites. Hate to say we told you so. And so much for that, part two. Despite his obsession and promises, Trump has not only failed to close what he thinks is a problematic trade gap, he's exploded it. And meet the theocratic homophobe who will be on the federal judiciary until well past I am dead. In fact, meet a bunch of them. In the House, Dems delay vote on the anti-Omar resolution. Kristen Nielsen grilled by House Democrats. And Mitch McConnell will not allow a vote on H.R. 1 because it is aimed directly at corruption and voting difficulties. Meanwhile, Trump's rollbacks will increase CO2 by 200 million tons annually. And when it comes to disasters and chemical dangers, the EPA just doesn't want to know. And lastly, a Clinton triangulator finds a new center, or I should say, really lastly, Mike Bloomberg, we hardly knew you.
All this, I would have won, but, you know, what are you going to do?
All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. Matt is behind the board today. Matt, how are you? Matt. Brendan. Matt is not. I'm really...
Oh, I thought you were joking. I thought you were setting up a name
I'm
joke.
I'm really having trouble accessing things over the past day or two.
We need to get you some neurotropics, I think.
I think that's probably what it is.
We need to
oh,
get
I didn't,
you set
I didn't
up.
Have my neurotropic this morning. I mean, I never do, but I didn't have my...
I think Matt's doing crossword puzzles.
Yeah, exactly. John Benjamin was actually...
doing neurotropics?
No, the answer to the New York Times crossword puzzle of the weekend.
Whoa.
That's pretty
He awesome. Has arrived.
Right? That's pretty
crazy. That's pretty
I look
up
forward
there.
To explaining who he is to my grandparents.
Well,
because
they
do
don't
it every
know,
day.
Then they could not get it. All right, let's first start with this. As we speak, Kristen Nielsen is lying to Congress. And this is really pretty shocking how, I mean, we have a couple of clips. It's ongoing. But one of the things that she's complaining about is that and I don't know exactly how this is, but one of the problems, apparently, according to her, is that there's so many migrants coming that it's unfair to them to be able to look at their asylum claims. As opposed to, we just have specifically degraded the apparatus to, A, look at their asylum claims. B, we have narrowed the ability for them to claim asylum in a myriad of ways. That's not the problem. The problem is there's just too much demanded. It's unfair to the demanders. Here she is. I don't know what you would call this, just a performance.
To your knowledge, are you aware of family members who've been separated from their children and deported back to a country without their children?
Yes, sir.
Can you provide this committee with a list of those individuals?
I'm happy to do that with the one caveat that, as you know, that's part of ongoing litigation in Ms. L. And as long as there's no privacy concerns from the court, of course, we're happy to provide that. A lot of the information is in the Ms. L. court with respect to each migrant. I would also just note that, consistent with longstanding practice and the law, before we deport any alien after they have gone through the process and receive a final order of removal, we do ask them if they would like to take their children with them. At that same time, their consulate or embassy, for purposes of issuing them travel papers, also asks them, would you like to be removed with your children as you're removed? As part of Ms. L., the judge also asked us to go back and ask the parents again in conjunction with the ACLU, which we did. So there was no parent who has been deported, to my knowledge, without multiple opportunities to take their children with them.
I don't think so. There you go. Yeah, to her knowledge, they're all those stories you're hearing about that are all fraudulent, to her knowledge. They've all been asked. Really disgusting. The only thing that is in any way, the only thing that gives me any solace is the dry mouth that she has. Makes me indicate at least that she knows deep inside her that she is full of it. Let's just look at the first of the protests. Young people who were there in a silent protest who ended up getting led out.
Including very small children.
Here it is. Here, there, you can see. And then there's a couple of, and there's a small child being held, baby. And they are here as part of, you know, while she's testifying, and they're being, I guess, ushered out of the room at this point. Some sense that at least there are people who are protesting this. And this is, of course, the Government Accountability or Government Oversight Committee in the House. And you know what that means. The Republicans have brought out their A-team. Here is the, what's his name? Cal Higgins? Is that it? Clay Higgins. Let's start with Clay Higgins and then just sort of like, if you can, just shove him out of the way so that we can once. So here, put him up there. And this is Clay Higgins. He's from Tennessee. He's the one who couldn't quite follow the idea in the Cohen hearings that Cohen was looking through his boxes of evidence to pull stuff for the committee hearing, but it was boxes of evidence that had been collected by the FBI, had been sorted through by the FBI to determine what they wanted and what they were going to record, and then given back to him. Higgins kept saying over and over again, shouldn't investigators have this material? And Cohen kept trying to explain, no, they've had it, and they gave it back because they've already done their investigations. Apparently, Higgins himself was in law enforcement and was not aware of this dynamic. But here he is.
I believe that.
Talking, yes, I do too. I believe there's nothing that Higgins says that I find beyond belief. Here is Higgins talking about the desperate migrants coming to the border, families, children. I heard that story the other day of police officers in El Salvador escaping the country because they were afraid. And here's Higgins explaining what this dynamic really is.
Let me just put this in context for the American people. Perhaps the most famous invasion in the history of the world, D-Day. 73,000 American troops.
Let's pop this baby up there.
Landed in the D-Day invasion. We have 76,103, according to my numbers, apprehensions along our southern border last month. We have D-Day every month on our southern border. Just to put this in context for America, yes, physical barriers work, enhanced technology works. Let me just put this in context for the American people. Perhaps the most famous invasion in the history of the world, D-Day. 73,000 American troops landed in the D-Day invasion.
Okay, we've seen enough there.
26,103, according to...
There it is. Higgins providing us context. What's happening with these families that are walking up to the border hoping to get asylum is just like D-Day. That's the context that he wants there. It's like an invasion of tens of thousands of armed troops. Just sheer insanity that's going on with these Republicans and the border at this point.
Armed with dangerous workaholism, perhaps.
Right, exactly. They're coming with the most violent aspirations of their children of getting an education and working hard for their future.
They even have SAT prep books that they have translated into Spanish. I mean, this is like D-Day.
Just like D-Day.
Just like D-Day. In the same way that we want to make America just like Venezuela, people seeking refuge, just like D-Day.
Just like D-Day. Folks, reminder, one of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth, yet most of us don't do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. Quip was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable. It has sensitive sonic vibrations, it's gentle on your sensitive gums, and the built-in two-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when you switch sides, guide you to a full and even clean. And here's the best part, in my estimation. Quip does not require a clunky charger. It can fit basically in your toothbrush holder, on your sink. So you don't have the thing that's going to knock over and fall on the floor, and then your toothbrush is going to be dirty. The whole point, that happened, I'm telling
you. So gross.
Been there.
Gross. Keep it clean with Quip.
That is my favorite part about the Quip, is that it's basically like a normal toothbrush, except for it's an electric. And electric toothbrushes, ones that have these pulses, are far more effective. And the whole point is you use them. In fact, and this isn't in the copy, but I just noticed that they have kids' version now. So guess who's going to get one?
Not me. Both of your kids?
Yes, both my kids. But, I mean, they've been using a regular size. But now, you know, Saul in particular, going to get him a little small one. It's going to be it's for his birthday.
Aw, Solly.
That's why I love Quip and why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. Every 3 months, I should say, they send you a new brush head and a new battery and a new little thing of toothpaste, too. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. Also, support for today's show comes from Third Love. Third Love uses data points generated by millions of women who have taken their Fit Finder quiz to design bras with breast size and shape in mind. The results, a perfect fit and a premium feel. All you got to do is you simply answer a few questions to find your perfect fit within 60 seconds. Then, once you receive your bra, you can wear it, you can wash it, you can put it to the test for 60 days. And if you don't love it, you return it, and Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. It's all part of their 100% fit guarantee. This is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own. It has straps that won't slip, tagless labels, and lightweight, super thin memory foam cups. They even have a line of incredibly soft and breathable cotton bras. I am not a bra wearer.
But really?
Our official Majority Report bra wearer says, I like they don't have a zillion options. It's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two. Both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most T-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details so I don't feel basic. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra. Get 15% off your first purchase. That's Third Love. Spell it out. thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. So check those out. I should also say, before we move on to some other stuff I want to talk about, want to talk about what's going on with Ilhan Omar, because this is just a real crap show.
Despicable. Disgusting.
It's also just... like politically shooting, the Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot. But before I do, yesterday was my sister's birthday and tomorrow is my son's birthday and I won't be here tomorrow. And so happy birthday to Julie and happy birthday to Saul. Saul is turning 6.
Wow. That's amazing.
A lot of Pisces in your family, huh?
I had no idea. Is that right?
I mean, I'm a Pisces, and my birthday is March 9th, so I assume they are
as
Sam, you have a thing with Pisces. Something's going on here.
Well, I mean, my sister, my son. But so happy birthday to them.
That's your natal chart, bro.
All right, let's get into this. We should probably just talk about Schultz. We'll do that in a bit. I want to do this Ilhan Omar stuff. So today was the day that HR1, that we're going to do the big rollout, right? HR1, the first bill that the first House resolution won, this was going to be the first piece of legislation that the Democrats roll out. This involves all sorts of voting reforms, voter registration, campaign finance, matching funds, anti-corruption measures, a great piece of legislation that was not going to get passed in the Senate. In fact, Mitch McConnell has said he will not even put it up for a vote. But the value of this is basically to stick a flag in the ground, as it were, and say, this is what we intend to do the day that we take the Senate. It is an attempt to restore the protections under the Voting Rights Act. It is looking to restore voting rights for formerly incarcerated. It supports the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. There's redistricting reform. Unfair purging of the voter rolls stopped. Modernization and some type of consistency in voting across the country. There's a lot of very positive things in this bill. And Mitch McConnell... part because I think K Street is obviously super upset about this because it deals with lobbying and ethics overhauls as well. Mitch McConnell announces that the bill's not even going to get a vote in the Senate. And the reason why you're not going to hear that much about that story today is because, A, the press is pretty bad at covering Mitch McConnell. But, B, Democrats are not spending the past 3 or 4 days or week, frankly, building up to this moment and hammering the Republicans over this. They're not gaining the advantage of publicizing how Republicans want to suppress the vote. The part of this bill also makes it a federal holiday for federal workers so that they can go vote. This voting reforms should have been a marquee package. That's all that we should be hearing about, particularly in the past couple of days. It's been a slow news days. However, they're not, because the Democratic leadership buckled maybe buckled is the wrong word, but has been insistent upon writing up a censure bill, essentially, to censure Ilhan Omar because of statements that she didn't even make or statements that they have mischaracterized. And we touched on this the other day, and I wasn't going to bring it up again, but we got an email addressed to us in response to the thing that we talked about with Barry Weiss, who was commenting on this on The View. Okay? And put Barry Weiss aside, all right? She is...
Gladly.
I mean, but
she
honestly...
She is my black swan, and I do not like her.
Right. Put her aside, because she's really a sideshow to this. This emailer writes that he agrees with us that claiming that criticism of Israel, much like criticism of France, cannot be considered inherently anti-Semitic. On this, I agree with you entirely. The problem with this offering, the emailer writes, offering this as a response, is that on not one of these three occasions that Ilhan Omar has been publicly censured for alleged anti-Semitism has she criticized a specific policy or conduct of the Israeli government. Instead of delving into the actual detail of where U.S. policy has gone wrong vis-a-vis the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, she chooses instead to peddle in anti-Semitic tropes about Israel supporters in the U.S., be it invoking the image of Jewish money being nefariously used to control American politics with her AIPAC statements, or accusing Israel supporters of dual, this is a quote, dual allegiances or dual loyalty. I want you to put just, I want you to note those two, everything that's been said there. The emailer writes, to be clear, it's possible to level legitimate criticism of the Israel lobby without falling into anti-Semitic thinking. However, that requires understanding the Israel lobby for what it really is, which is a loosely connected, often competing group of organizations across which wide ranges of spectrum of opinion on what Israel ought to be doing, what the Israel U.S. policy towards Israel ought to be. It requires actual specific issues with what these organizations do, then rather than attempting to delegitimize support for Israel as reasonable in a democracy. He goes on to say, if you actively criticize AIPAC, you'd have no disagreement from people like me or Barry Weiss. Well, put aside Barry Weiss because I think you're wrong about that. But totally wrong. But that's not the point.
Her dad's in AIPAC.
Like I say, I don't want to get caught up in that. In summary on this specific point, while criticism of Israel is by no means inherently anti-Semitic, full disclosure, I've actually been to the West Bank and participated in activism with the goal of ending the occupation. That doesn't mean it can never be. Goes on to say, you begin applying old anti-Semitic ideas that were previously leveled at individual Jews, for example, using money to control the world and just transfer the target from the Jew to the Jewish state. You're getting to very tricky territory. All right, so let me show you how this guy has moved the ball in the same way that critics of Ilhan Omar have. Okay? Because Ilhan Omar was not criticizing even Israel in these statements. She was criticizing the fact that she is unable to criticize Israel without being attacked. And she is criticizing the fact that Congress would take up a bill that would punish people for supporting protests against Israel. She never, ever, ever uses the words, quote, dual allegiances or, quote, dual loyalty. And to the extent that she talks about anybody having loyalty to another country, she is criticizing not Jews. She's criticizing members of Congress. Let's listen to what one of the things that she said. Now, we know the exchange on Twitter where she's asking, like, why people are voting on behalf of AIPAC. And she says, because of the money, which is exactly what Thomas Friedman said. Exactly. Although Thomas Friedman, to be fair, was far more explicit.
Yeah. And he also said people in non-electoral roles as well.
Yes.
He was explicit and broader.
He was explicit and broader. But let's listen to what Ilhan Omar said that supposedly involves. First off, let's listen to this. This exchange here is on. Where is this exchange?
I-24.
On I-24, where the debate is happening as to what Ilhan Omar does. And this woman here, I don't know who it is.
She's on Fox News a bunch.
Okay, some Fox News person does exactly what the emailer does.
We're allowed to talk about the gun lobby, that we're allowed to talk about the oil lobby and the fossil fuel lobby, but only the Israel lobby we're not allowed to talk about. It's completely and utterly absurd.
That's absolutely not true.
Ilhan talks about,
she attacked American Jews.
Ilhan, for example, calls for a boycott of Saudi Arabia. Does that mean she's anti-Muslim?
To this nation. That is not true, and I will have my say.
She never said anything about American Jews having dual loyalty. You are making this up. I mean, just have the decency. Can you cite it? When did she say that Jews have dual loyalty to the U.S.? When did she say that?
She said she questioned citizens.
I challenge you to produce a single fact that she made that reference.
She said.
What did she say?
She said that she challenges those citizens who have dual loyalty and conflicted loyalty to the United States.
That is utterly, utterly ridiculous. She has never made that comment.
Okay. So. She didn't use the word citizens. She didn't use the word loyalty. Listen to this.
And what I am fearful of is that because Rashida and I are Muslim, that a lot of our Jewish colleagues, a lot of our constituents, a lot of our allies go to thinking that everything we say about Israel to be an anti-Semitic because we are Muslim. And so to me, it's something that becomes designed to end the debate. Because you get in this space of, yes, right? Like, I know what intolerance looks like, and I'm sensitive when someone says the words you use, Ilhan, are resemblance of intolerance. And I am cautious of that, and I feel pained by that. But it almost as if every single time we say something, regardless of what it is we say, that is supposed to be about foreign policy, our engagement, our advocacy about ending oppression, or the freeing of every human life and wanting dignity, we get to be labeled in something and that ends the discussion because we end up defending that. And nobody ever gets to have the broader debate of what is happening with Palestine.
Okay, so here she's just simply talking about the fact that she is subject to critiques because she is Muslim. And she is automatically considered suspect. Do we have the other clip where she talks about, specifically where she talks about people being... loyal to the other country? I don't think she said that in there, did she?
I think my understanding is that that's the clip that they're extrapolating that from.
She doesn't say about another loyalty, does she?
That's certainly not what I heard.
No, there's another one, I think, where she said, but she never uses the word dual loyalty. She never uses the word that in regards to Jews.
I
know where the exchange is. I think that was written, actually. Hold on for a second. Paul Waldman has written very well about this, actually. And she said, okay, I should not be expected to have allegiance, pledge support to a foreign country in order to serve my country in Congress or serve on my committee. So she's not referring to Jews having that. She's saying that I should not be expected to have that. She's referring to Congress people. She's referring to herself as a congressperson. Here it is. Here is the tweet. Our democracy is built on debate, Congresswoman. She's responding to Nita Lowey. I should not be expected to have allegiance / pledge support to a foreign country in order to serve my country in Congress or serve on committee. The people of the Fifth elected me to serve their interests. I'm sure we agree on that. She's not implying that Jews have this dual allegiance because let's face it, as Paul Waldman points out, for decades now, the vast majority of Jews in this country are critical of Israel. that the most amount of support in terms of citizenry in this country comes from Christian evangelicals.
Yeah, and plenty of Jews in Israel are also critical of Israel.
That's true. But in the context of Americans, she's not even talking about actual citizens or average citizens. She's talking about Congress people. And when she talks about signing a pledge, how many people listening to me now, and this emailer who has emailed me, it's from Britain, are aware that in half the states in this country, you must sign a pledge if you are getting a contract with the state that you will not participate in a protest against Israel. This is not a joke. There was a lawsuit that was brought by a Texas woman who provides speech pathology services to the school, and she had to sign a pledge in Texas that she would not participate in BDS if she was going to take this job. There is a, where was it? In Arkansas.
A small town newspaper.
Jewish-oriented state of Arkansas.
The Little Rock's Arkansas Times, the owner, Alan Leverett, I don't know if Leverett is Jewish or not, but the University of Arkansas Pulaski Technical College would not advertise in the Arkansas Times unless Leverett signed a pledge that his business does not boycott Israel. Now, Leverett does not boycott Israel, but he considers a state law that forces him to pledge not to boycott Israel unconstitutional. That's what she's referring to. And we mentioned that the Democrats are shooting themselves in the foot because they're not talking about H.R. 1 this week. Well, S.R. 1 was a bill brought up in the Senate to federalize this ban, so that it's not just the 27 states, it is the entire country. You cannot have a contract with the federal government unless you pledge not to boycott Israel. I mean, this is bizarre.
Well, it's an actual assault on free speech in the actual world.
Dramatic assault on free speech.
It kind of makes me think that BDS might actually work on some level.
That's wholly irrelevant. The effectiveness of it, whether people are supported or not, the idea that you would have to pledge to not protest a foreign country or this country for that matter, or anything for that matter, is absurd. And when she calls that out, she is smeared as saying that Jews have a dual loyalty to their country. No, she's saying I shouldn't be forced as a member of Congress. And frankly, none of the citizens in the country should be forced to pledge allegiance to not protesting against Israel. I mean, regardless of whether you think there is a comparison or not with South Africa, the idea that people would have been, that you could not do business with a federal or state government if you protested against South Africa 30 some odd years ago would be laughed out of the room, particularly by Democrats. So at the expense of a marquee bill, the Democrats decided to bring up this, essentially to codify this smear against one of their, frankly, rising stars. And it's incredibly disingenuous. And I will add this, that I took this critique from this email, even though it was doing exactly what the smear is. She never says dual allegiances, quote, unquote. She never says dual loyalty, quote, unquote. She never's talking about Jews. She's talking about congresspeople and herself being expected to do this. She doesn't talk about Jews whatsoever. In fact, Jews, that smear of Jews that they had dual loyalty is silly in the context of modern America, because 75% of Jews in this country critique Israel. And beyond that, I will say, I'm going pretty far down the road by taking this seriously, because it was just reported 3 days ago, maybe it was last week, that former Mossad agents form private security firms that harass people who support BDS. And I can tell you from my own experience.
Fake stories and harass.
Yeah, I can tell you from my own experience that in 2004, when Janine and I would critique Israel on the original Majority Report on Air America, the next day, we were contacted by the Israeli embassy. And we're basically told, we're going to send, I think it was Pincus at the time was the ambassador. We had the ambassador on a couple of times. So this type of stuff, and I said it yesterday and I will repeat it again. This is the greatest existential threat to Israel, in my opinion, because the days of pretending that Israel is not problematic and ignoring it and doing stuff like this is going to isolate Israel. It may take 5 or 10 years, but the tide has turned, and largely because of the actions of Israel. And I would say because of the right in this country. Because if you stifle debate in this way, you're doing a disservice to Israel. And I say this as someone who is a supporter of Israel. You're doing a disservice to Israel. You're basically saying like, you know what? They've had a lot to drink, but you just don't let them drive. Let them drive. That's basically what's happening.
I also just, can I broaden it a bit? Yeah. Everything is 100% on point. But I think that also, you know, in addition to her courage on Israel, and also, by the way, this is ridiculous to have to do, but this is somebody who said it as an example that the Hajj should be boycotted because of what's happening in Saudi Arabia, which is an extraordinary position of a Muslim to hold. She's also been obviously opposed to a coup in Venezuela, and what she did to Elliot Abrams seriously pissed a lot of people off. And I think the dangerous play here, and this is, I'll bring Barry Weiss up, not to bring her up, but Barry Weiss in that clip yesterday said she's on the Foreign Relations Committee. And Steve Scalise, David Duke without the baggage, which I know we'll get to, is getting at this as well. So in addition to the disgusting, craven display of Democratic leadership to even consider throwing her under the bus like this, and also just the pure disingenuousness. Like I said a couple of weeks ago, is the only quarter that I would give on this is like, if somebody had a genuine concern about this, you could easily have this conversation with her privately, which frankly, I think in general is a better thing to do with allies, period, across the board with regards to these things. But the real aim here is to get her off of the Foreign Relations Committee because she represents more broadly a courageous and different voice.
Right, yeah. And not just in regards to Israel.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I just said. Latin America, Saudi Arabia, across the board. I mean, she is somebody saying something different here. And then you add this to the context of the levels of incitement in this country, where on simultaneously you're completely underplaying the fact that, as an example, there was a terrorist attack against Jews a couple of months ago by a deranged right-winger. And I don't even want to put out into the atmosphere, God knows, the types of threats that Ilhan Omar is facing. And leaders in her party are not unequivocally condemning it and protecting her as both a political threat, maybe even a physical threat. And I have to say, like, you know, I did this more last night, but I'll just do one sentence. Like, AOC is prevaricating, and there's no room for prevarication. She needs complete, utter, no BS protection. This is disgusting and dangerous.
Yeah, I totally agree on that. She needs to stand up for her colleague and comrade. I'm sure all of the free speech warriors in the intellectual dark web are rushing to condemn this literal restriction on freedom of speech.
I'm
going
to need to read more about that, but YouTube demonetization.
Specifically to get onto the point as to why they want Ilhan Omar off of the Foreign Services Committee. Here is a guy who literally introduced himself to a some type of Elks Club. I can't remember exactly what the context was when he was out running for election the first time as David Duke without the baggage. Now, I suppose there's a good interpretation of that. That someone somewhere has the imagination to come up with. I, for one, can't. Maybe there was other things that David Duke was involved in. Was it like financial chicanery,
Steve,
maybe?
Yes, I don't know, being on an all-meat diet.
Right. But here is Steve Scalise. This is the height of disingenuousness, but I don't, you know, this I expect. This I expect. But the idea of Democrats echoing this unabashed racist line of thinking and this idea that somehow, I mean, here he is accusing her of dual loyalties, right? And go ahead.
Well, the resolution only addresses a piece of the problem. She continues to display anti-Semitic remarks, comments. These are her beliefs. And so if they really are serious about addressing the problem, Nancy Pelosi has to remove her from the Foreign Affairs Committee. She's literally getting intelligence briefings on foreign policy of the United States, including our relationship with Israel, as she makes these kind of comments where she thinks any support of Israel is denouncing your own nationality. Where does that come from? It's a deep-rooted belief that shows the core of her convictions. And again, everybody's entitled to their own beliefs, but why would you have her on a committee that important, that sensitive to our foreign policy, if she has those kind of anti-Semitic beliefs, unless you're willing to tolerate it, and it shouldn't be tolerated. She ought to be removed immediately from the Foreign Affairs Committee.
The response by Nancy Pelosi to Steve Scalise is, you've got to be joking. That's the only legitimate response to that guy. You've got to be joking. Because he's got to be joking.
Guy who runs on an overt white supremacy message. Again, this is incitement. And I don't throw those terms around. Like, I've been, you know, I'm someone who's critical, I think, of people on the left for going to that too quickly in a fair amount of cases, particularly online. But, like, that literally, if you couple that with the atmosphere and increase of hate crimes in this country, the West Virginia travesty with her and the 9/11 poster, this guy is, I mean, what's he implying by that? He's saying this is a Muslim woman who's getting intelligence briefings. The clear implication is some Frank Gaffney nut conspiracy that she, what is she passing intelligence
right. of
to somebody?
She's giving it to Al Shabaab.
Of course.
That's what he's doing. He's inciting it right there.
And I think the idea of this is, of course, is this is, you know, this is one of the ways that they hope to run. And this is one of the ways that they hope to sort of get the Democrats off message. And frankly, it's worked. And Nancy Pelosi should get a grip and, frankly, censure those members of her caucus who go out and smear a fellow member of the caucus.
Make a list.
Yeah, well, Democrats get money from AIPAC, too, right?
Yeah, and I don't think it's just...
And definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like, Bernie and AOC need to be brave in this instance like they are in other ones, and they're kind of disappointing me right now.
Bernie's been better on this, frankly.
I mean,
at least he hasn't sort of hemmed and hawed and prevaricated on Twitter.
All right, this is sort of fun. I want to just switch topics here and talk about this because Brad DeLong is a guy that I've been aware of, you know, like online for an extended period of time, and I have various times he's had blogs that I've read to get his perspective on some of these things, because it's interesting to know who is advising the Democratic establishment at any given time. And so he was a guy who was, I think, a deputy assistant secretary for the Treasury under the Clinton administration. He is a self-described neoliberal Reubenite. He wrote a piece, I don't know where he posted this, but calls himself a Reuben Democrat. He, speaking of Robert Reuben, who was the Treasury Secretary under Clinton, and then also had a lot of influence under Obama as well. He wrote an op-ed the other day basically saying, we failed politically, and it is time for us to hand over the baton to the left of the Democratic Party. And let me just read some of this interview that he did with Zach Beauchamp and Vox. Beauchamp? Because it's interesting. But there's another point I want to make here, too, that it starts with, the baton rightly passes to our colleagues on the left. We're still here, but it's not our time to lead. The core reason, DeLong argues, is political. He goes on to say, when asked what movement he identifies with, I would say it's largely neoliberal, market-oriented, and market regulation and tuning aimed at social democratic ends. Rubin Democrats believe you should prioritize economic growth, the idea being that we can look to the market to provide the material needs of, at the very least, those people who are in the worst positions economically in the country, right? So that's how we provide a safety net, and we raise all boats by a rising tide. And he goes on to say, we were 100% wrong on the politics, particularly in the context of the Obama administration. He says, Barack Obama rolls into office with Mitt Romney's healthcare policy, with John McCain's climate policy, with Bill Clinton's tax policy, and George H.W. Bush's foreign policy. He's all these things, not because the technocrats in his administration think they're the best policies possible, but because White House advisor David Axelrod and company say they poll well. And he says all of these with the idea that you could then collect a broad political coalition behind what is indeed Romney's healthcare policy, McCain's climate policy, H.W. Bush's foreign policy. And did George H.W. Bush and Mitt Romney, did John McCain say a single good word about anything Barack Obama ever did over the course of 8 solid years? No, they fucking did not, he says. No allegiance to the truth on anything other than the belief that John Boehner, Paul Ryan, and Mitch McConnell are the leaders of the Republican Party. And since they've decided on scorched earth, where we back them to the hilt. This is a guy who learned the lesson. Sadly, not in real time, but better late than never.
He will not see the inside of a gulag.
Today, there's literally nobody on the right between those frantically accommodating Donald Trump on the one hand and us on the other, except for our brave friends in exile in the Cato Institute now trying to build something. And then he goes...
he actually has a good line about that, though, later on. I don't know if it's in that same point.
Yes. Well, it's similar. He goes on to say, he says, when you say, he's asked, when you say pass the baton to the left, does that mean give up on substantive policies? Meaning meaning Rubin Democrats disagree with the left? And he goes, no, it means argue with them to the extent that their policies are going to be wrong and destructive, but also accept there is no political path to a coalition built from the Rubin center out. Instead, we accommodate ourselves to those to our left.
Bend the knee.
On some level, that's what he's saying. To the extent that they will not respond to our concerns, what they're proposing is a hell of a lot better than the poke in the eye with the sharp stick. That's either Trumpist proposals or the current status. In other words, he's saying you can have an argument with the left to try and fix their policy proposals, but at the end of the day, know that the worst case scenario in terms of capitulating to the left is far better than anything that is to the right of us. And he goes on to say that we need to reorient who our coalition is, and we need to accept policies that we think are suboptimal because they are far more... they are far more acceptable than anything we would get from the right. And he goes, until something non-rubblish is built in the Republican center, what might be good incremental policies just cannot be successfully implemented in an America as we know it today. We need Medicare for all, funded by a carbon tax, with a whole bunch of UBI rebates for the poor and public investment in green technologies. That's the best policy given the political economic context. If the political economic context were distant, were different, well, I'm fundamentally a neoliberal shill. But he goes on to say, our current bunch of leftists, as far as our wonderful people, as far as leftists in the past are concerned, they're social democrats. They're very strong believers in democracy. They're very strong believers in fair distribution of wealth. He goes on. He can't help himself to be. They could use a little more education about what's likely to work and what's not. But they're people who we're very, very lucky to have on our side. That's especially opposed to the people on the other side who are very, very strange indeed. You listen to never Trump conservatives like Tom Nichols or Bruce Bartlett or Bill Kristol or David Frum talk about all the people they had been in meetings with biting their tongues over the past 25 years. And your reaction can only be, why didn't you run away screaming into the night long ago?
That was right. Because that was where he slightly redeemed himself from the Cato.
That is exactly what he's saying.
You know, I'll take as much neoliberal scolding as he wants to dish out as long as he's willing to bend the knee.
That's exactly right. And so this is, and be clear here, what he's saying is that our politics failed and we have no better options than I don't think he would say bend the knee, but he was saying we have no better options than capitulating to the left, even again, if their policies are suboptimal.
Yeah, and we'll see about that.
I would just add that Mike Konzel from the Roosevelt Institute jumped in on this and said the failures of neoliberalism are bigger than its politics.
Right.
In other words, it's not just that there was a misunderstanding and misapprehension and miscomprehension of what partners they would find if they took steps to the right of the Rubin Democrat, the neoliberal perspective. It's not just that they failed to find partners there, because at the end of the day, John McCain was a was in it to win it and didn't care about any policy. Mitt Romney, also not a good faith actor. Neither George Herbert Walker Bush or any of them. It's also because their policies failed. And Konzel lays it out like this. He says there are two basic premises of the neoliberal policies. One is that these policies would create more growth, so that, yes, inequality might increase, but so would wages. So economic growth first, redistribution and beefing up the safety net second. And he says the other premise of neoliberal policies was if we get government out of corporations' way, the market would become more dynamic and competitive and innovative. And he goes on to say that the first premise, that neoliberal policies would create more growth, and this in turn all boats would rise, was a total failure. The positive effects, he says, Konzel says, of more inequality never happened. Starting in 1980, the growth rate of the economy slowed. While the economy grew at 3.9% from 1950 to 1980, since 1980, it's only grown at a rate of 2.6. And more problematic is the rate of increase of relative mobility. The rate at which people would rise up and down the economic ladder flattened compared to that same period, the Great Compression, as they call it. And he said, worse, absolute income mobility, whether you're better off than your parents, has also fallen. So the idea that neoliberalism would create more growth and that this growth would provide more opportunities, even if there was more inequality, every aspect of that fell apart. It didn't create more growth, and it certainly created less, far less opportunity.
And that was the core. I mean, when people like Peter Mandelson and New Labour said that we're intensely relaxed about the rich getting super rich, this is the, but it was always followed by, as long as everything's going up, exactly, as long as we're cutting poverty, as long as we're improving living standards, then the oligarchs can go to the top.
The second was that if you take the shackles off of business, they would innovate and grow out of social problems. So there was relaxation of antitrust enforcement because it would lead to more competition, right? We've talked about this. Talked about the Bork School of antitrust taking over in the 80s. Unions would no longer get in the way of business. An unleashed financial sector would fund and lead the entire enterprise, right? All the innovation. The idea of market power concentration was seen as laughable concepts stacked against the disciplining power of the markets themselves. Well, the story of the financial sector is quite obvious, but he also goes on to say there are two broader things that happen alongside it. First, at the level of individual firms, is that firm dynamism has fallen dramatically. The rate of business startups has fallen. In turn, this has shifted the age curve of businesses further out, with firms over 11 years accounting for 70% of the workers in 2000, but 75% of the workers in 2014. This is where jobs are created when new firms are created.
And I also just want to remind people that this kind of policy has not in practice been a truly free market policy. Like, they have made many laws and measures to sort of tinker with the market and prop it up, which is not generally what you associate with neoliberalism, but is a very important part.
Yes. And but I think, like, you know, the regulations that are in there are targeted. He's talking about the broad perspective of neoliberalism, which is basically get out of the way of antitrust being the biggest single roadblock to the to competition and dynamism in the markets. And none of that worked out. You had a decrease in the number of firms that are created, a decrease in the number of jobs that are created. You had less labor market mobility. The politics of neoliberalism have failed, but so too have the policies failed. And it's probably the case on some level that they're related, although that's probably another post at one point. But it's interesting to see when you have folks like Brad DeLong stepping up and basically saying, let's give up the ghost. There is real value to this. There is real value to this because it makes it that much harder, never mind for Howard Schultz, but it makes it that much harder for those on the right of the Democratic Party. Like, you know, what is Joe Biden going to say now? There was a story by Zach Carter about Joe Biden's being one of the Democratic architects of this new era of antitrust that has been so disastrous, fighting Ted Kennedy on this 30 years ago. But even for folks like Booker and Harris and Klobuchar and others, I mean, there's probably about
Gillibrand.
Five. Gillibrand.
Hickenlooper.
Certainly Hickenlooper. But for these folks to lose the cover of intellectuals in that movement, at the very least in terms of the politics, is really problematic for them.
Well, and also even at a very, you know, at a more base level, just the resentful, destructive Clinton apparatchik still putting out the, like, oh, the Clintons are just really concerned that Bernie can't beat, you know, Trump, which is like, okay, guys, I don't know if that's the people we want to be listening to advice on how to beat Trump, but more broadly, like, this is the whole intellectual edifice of it, right? Like, this is the stuff that's supposed to sustain all of the pettiness. Now, these are the actual arguments that are evaporating.
To be fair, from his perspective, I should say to be fair, but to be clear-eyed about this, were I worried about a Bernie candidacy, I would be telling Booker and Harris, you got to position yourself to as far left as you can get right now.
Oh, definitely. Of course.
You know, because he's not out there saying Bernie's the true.
Oh, no. He's definitely not saying that. I'm not putting that onto him at all. I just think that, you know, particularly. Well, I mean, you're right. It's actually,
but
in some
is,
ways.
But this is the dynamic we want.
This
right?
is exactly the dynamic we
They're
want.
They're out there with pitchforks.
Right.
So you guys better be doing something inside here to keep them
and
at bay.
And it vindicates the left argument, and then it gives another example for, like, the center of how they want to play it. And obviously, people like Kamala Harris have a bit more room. I think the thing with Biden is, like, they're just, how could he possibly pivot? Because that Czar Carta piece is so good. I mean, it goes, there's the top lines that everybody knows, credit cards, Iraq, all of this stuff. But you go back to the 70s and it's like, wait, Joe Biden was fighting Ted Kennedy on behalf of Coca-Cola?
Right.
Mean, Jesus Christ.
Right.
Well, I'm going to do something a little uncharacteristic of me and defend neoliberalism for a second. Not now, but like in the 70s, maybe. You gonna drop a sound here?
Yeah, I was going to. I can't find that. Hey, what happened? All right, go ahead.
Hey, what happened? So clearly, I guess there's like a few distinctions I want to make, because I think neoliberalism is a word that gets thrown around a lot because it has several different meanings, right? There's the policy, like you've been talking about. There's the accompanying ideology that sort of supports and justifies the policy. And then there's just as a periodization within capitalist development. So in the 70s, we know things got all messed up. We were having oil shocks. We were having a debt crisis. We were having stagflation, which was a thing that wasn't even supposed to be able to happen, but it did. Everything was crazy. And, you know, the people in charge of policy and the economy were like, okay, we need to get rid of Keynesian economics. We need a new kind of policy that's going to like get everything stabilized so that, you know, capitalist development can continue and the world won't be thrown into a recession because, you know, these folks thought the alternative would be worse, right? The alternative would be global recession or even like a revolution, just like anything to resolve this crisis. So they came up with these policies and, you know, in some ways it did stabilize the economy. But I think it's run its course now, and it was foolish for any of them to think that we had reached the end of history in the 90s and all that we had to do now was like, you know, some kind of technocratic tinkering around the edges, in which case being a centrist would make sense. So I guess in that sense, it wasn't the result of like bad people having bad morals and making bad choices from that. You know, it was like it was very much overdetermined by what capitalist development was doing at the time. And I think now the question is, can we set the clock back to the Keynesian era? Is that possible? Or do we need to change the relations of production in some essential way so that we don't keep having these kinds of crises?
Okay, this is like one of those movies where you get struck by electricity and then we switch bodies. Because I'm going to say I do not think those ideas came from such a benign place. They came 30 years earlier in the wake of World War II at Mount Pelerin when guys like Mises and Hayek got together and they were basically saying they were worried about sovereignty of nations overriding corporations. And they wanted to make sure that governments functioned on behalf of business. And so
they were always those folks with those ideas. Don't get me wrong.
They are the ones who launched these ideas. They are the ones who specifically developed them and then basically sent people out in the world to go and promulgate them.
But why were they able to take power? Why were they able to execute them at that exact point in time?
Well, I mean, I think that they were building on it, but I think yes, there was the opportunity arose, but they had been building infrastructure, and had been going and had been sort of building an intellectual movement around this these ideas of laissez-faire markets, supposedly. And so, yes, there was a weakness in the system that allowed this stuff to take over. But I think it was definitely it was fundamentally anti-democratic. And
I'm not saying it was democratic.
I think it was.
I mean, it's a dialectic, right? To use a word that I probably overuse. There had to be people with ideas and policies, and there also had to be a breaking point, a crisis in the market and in capitalist development.
That's the way all of this stuff works. That's how basically that's how religions get started. There's just people wandering out there, and then one day that's how Donald Trump becomes president. In my estimation, right? Like, you just, things line up in such a way, and there happens to be sort of a weakness, and the stars align, and then everything goes to the crap.
Yeah. Well, I think we kind of agree with each other at some level, but it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the next periodization is within capitalist development, because, I support reforms, obviously. Without being a reformist, I think people need reforms. People need healthcare and jobs and food and whatnot. But it'll be interesting to see if at the current point in capitalist development that we're at, which is very different than the post-World War II era, if those kinds of economics are going to work the same way, or if, you know, maybe we'll have another crisis and it'll help us make the case once again that we can't really reform this mode of production, this system. We need to keep going forward.
And with that, we will switch back into our regular scheduled bodies and go into the fun half of the program, wherein you can call us 646-257-3920. We will take your calls. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you support the free show, and then we give you extra content every day, and we give it to you all commercial free. Except for justcoffee.co-op, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Because they're a movement. They're movement supporters. And they're a great company. Check it out, jointhemajorityreport.com. Today is Wednesday. That means last night was Tuesday. That means Michael showed up for work and did the Michael Brooks show.
Sort of a courtesy to show up to work on TMPS Day, I feel. Ben Burgess joined us. We talked about logic for the left. We did a clinic on deconstructing basically right-wing arguments and what actual logic is. David Hume and the distinction between is and ought. It was fascinating stuff. And then commentary connecting the Bernie Sanders launch with Lula's temporary release to go to his grandson's funeral, and these two social democratic icons, one a front runner, the other a political prisoner. And then we stood with Ilhan Omar and had a very
packed. Save some for the show, will you?
Dude, this is like less than a fourth of it. A packed post game. Patreon.com/TMBS. Get the whole thing this Sunday, an illicit history of Caribbean debt. And also tickets to the LA Live show at the homepage with Anna Kasparian, Big Waz, and Nando Vila.
Jamie, do you want to do your show now, too?
And then in the 30-minute block.
Hello and welcome to the Antifada, where unrest is best. Yes, this week on the Antifada, are you a nerd like us? Do you read stories about robots in space while also pondering a socialist future? Well, do we have an interview for you? Fellow science fiction fanatic Will Meneker of Chapo Trap House joins Sean and Jamie, that's me, for an extended discussion with one of our favorite utopian futurists, Kim Stanley Robinson. Holy shit. Come for the revolutionary potentialities of the post-capitalist imaginary and stay for the psychedelic polyamory.
And Matt's not here, but check out Literary Hangover. Do you want to do a pitch, Brendan?
I think it's, is it still Wakefield with Nathaniel Hawthorne and Henry James on Hawthorne as well?
Sounds
these pretty sources
good.
include Dan McCall on Henry James's Hawthorne in the New England Review from 1997, and Henry James's Hawthorne by Matthew Peters from the Cambridge Quarterly in 2013, a little more recent.
Jesus.
It's an early, yeah,
all right.
About polyamory.
Quick break. Fun half. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Just wanna...